Allô?
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
So this is our first show for the year 2022. Imagine that. And in fact, today is, of course, the first day of 2022. So this is the first day in 2022 when we could be having a show. So that's kind of nifty. Yeah. What else is there to be said about that? Well, not a lot. Of course, on the 25th, which was Christmas Day, which is when we had our last show, there was the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, which, of course, is much anticipated. Been a long time coming. Part of the reason why it's been a long time coming is that it was initially supposed to have been launched on the what they call the Ares 5 launch vehicle, which has now essentially been rebranded as the Space Launch System, but for a while there it was canceled. And in any case, it became obvious it was not going to be available in any reasonable time, that it actually was going to cost less and take less time to completely re-engineer the telescope to fit into the payload shroud of the Ariane 5 launch vehicle. And instead of launching it, you know, from one of NASA's launch sites in the U.S., to actually launch it from Kourou in French Guiana, which is far from normal for a NASA project, I'll tell you what. So, the James Webb Space Telescope, of course, is a strange instrument in various ways. The first thing being that it's not named after an astronomer. You know, the Hubble, for example, named after an astronomer. The Kepler Space Telescope for discovering exoplanets, named after an astronomer. But the James Webb Space Telescope, named after a NASA administrator. Very odd choice. Now, I did see where there was a controversy where a person who identifies as non-binary gendered was trying to get the name of the James Webb Space Telescope quashed or replaced with somebody else on the grounds that Webb was biased against people of divergent sexualities and gender identities. That would honestly not have been my first thought as a reason for getting that, getting the name quashed, honestly. Because, as I say, it's really weird that it's named after an administrator. But yeah, the U.S. government back in the 60s, of course, had a bunch of policies which basically boiled down to, we believe that because we treat, for example, gay people badly in this country, therefore they're susceptible to blackmail and therefore they ought to be excluded from government jobs. And it seems like this is a kind of a weird weird ideological corner to paint yourself into. But, you know, what do I know? Right, the ideological corners that I paint myself into are not just a different color, but I think also a different shape from those that most other people do, and may in fact be oriented differently in space. But yeah, the thing about the JWST is that as an instrument, as an astronomical observation instrument, it's super specialized because it's a far infrared instrument, which is basically intended for cosmological studies, to look at the stuff, basically the thermal background of the universe, the stuff which is just slightly shorter wavelength than the microwave background. And so it's not going to take pretty pictures of galaxies. It's not going to take pretty pictures of stars. It's not going to do any of those things that the Hubble telescope did and has done. And so if people are expecting that from this amazing new instrument, they're really going to be disappointed. Now, the other thing is, of course, the NASA, as I've commented before, NASA as an agency of the United States government, seems to have this attitude that I find very strange, that anything that is not being used right now must be destroyed or put beyond use. I find that very strange. And that is the thing that, you know, they plan to do. They plan to deorbit the Hubble, you know, attach a rocket to it and put it into a, you know, boost it down so it brushes the top of the Earth's atmosphere and falls into the Indian Ocean. And what's really strange, so far as I'm concerned, is that it would not be very much more difficult to boost it the other direction into a parking orbit, a higher orbit, which would not decay, where eventually people could come along. Since, of course, remember, the Hubble is built to be visited and worked on, people could come and salvage parts of it or even potentially refurbish it and put it back into operation. The fact that NASA doesn't have any use for it anymore doesn't mean that no one will ever have a use for it. The same is true for the International Space Station, which they keep saying they're going to, you know, deorbit and crash it in a few years, just a few years. I mean, literally, the International Space Station at this point, you know, it took them longer to get it from initial items in orbit to fully operational, then they're going to let it exist? That doesn't make the least sense. But again, there's this attitude at NASA that if you have anything that you're not using right now, it must be destroyed or put permanently beyond use. Whereas, of course, the Russians, in the Soviet period, when anyone was told to cancel any program he was working on, they never canceled this stuff. They never scrapped it. They would just put a tarp over it and shove it into the side of the warehouse. There was a whole space program, basically, space stations and manned capsules and all this kind of thing. The ALMAZ program, that in the 1970s it was canceled, but what did they do with it? Well, the people working on it just put a tarp over it and shoved it to the side of the warehouse. And back less than 10 years ago, Art Dula actually bought a bunch of that stuff using a shell company he set up in the Isle of Man, and was planning to use it for manned space launches under the name of Excalibur ALMAZ. There was a lot of controversy over whether the stuff was still usable and whether it was legally usable or whether it had to be classified as museum pieces in order to export it from Russia. But now, the question that has arisen in my mind, and, you know, again, this is just me speculating, is whether there could be something else that could be done with the James Webb, right? I want to let you know what I think could potentially be done with the James Webb, and that is, so since it's basically focused on the thermal infrared, right? Since the James Webb Space Telescope is focused on the thermal infrared, that's the only thing it can sense, right? I mean, well, I say focused on. That's a stupid way to talk when I'm talking about a telescope. But since the James Webb Telescope is built to pick up thermal infrared, right, to look at things in the thermal infrared, then it could potentially be used to look at things that are not really very visible because they don't reflect or emit visible light very easily. Things in our solar system. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the synoptic survey, right? Which is really, really important if we all want to live through the coming few decades. So years, for many years now, right? For many years now, it has been considered kind of important that we should have knowledge of what kind of objects are out there in the solar system. Now, me, right, the people I know, talk to, care about, we're very interested in the question of things like, can we mine them? Can we use these objects in the solar system, these small subplanetary objects, for practical purposes? But honestly, right at the moment, our biggest concern is just, are they going to hit the Earth? Apparently, there's a new show on Netflix or somewhere, the whole thing of which is some astronomer discovers a comet that's going to slam into the Earth and is going to, cause massive catastrophe, continent-size crater, plunge the Earth into darkness for 1,000 years, wipe out all life larger than fleas. And goes around trying to tell people about it, and they just ignore him. And friends, this is my life, right? This is the world I live in. These people are the people I spend my time with, right? Because here's the thing. You may remember just a few years ago, 2013, right? February 2013. The Chelyabinsk meteor. Do you remember that? Do you? The thing is, that was a very lucky break. Why do I say that? Well, we're talking about a roughly 20-meter diameter object which entered the Earth's atmosphere at a shallow angle, less than 20 degrees. Now, typically, impacting objects may enter the atmosphere at a plunging angle, 70 to 80 degrees, right? Thing is, the amount of energy given off in the fireball, right, as an airburst, was, say, 400 to 500 kilotons of TNT equivalent, right, in terms of atom bomb yields. That's a big atomic bomb. Half a megaton, right? That's the size of a modern strategic warhead. And if it had come in at a plunging angle, particularly, you got to remember, Chelyabinsk was, back in the glory days of the nuclear arms race, Chelyabinsk was one of those closed cities where they worked on nuclear weapons. A megaton airburst over a nuclear weapons design and production center. That's the sort of thing that could trigger an exchange of nuclear weapons. That's the sort of thing we don't want, right? We don't want a stupid accident to set off a civilization-ending war, right? Right? Because that could really, really easily happen. A little less easily now than in the past, but frankly, the international situation is getting more and more concerning every day. And here's the thing. how much coverage do we have on these 20-meter diameter size objects? Answer, almost none. For years now, in fact, there's a charitable foundation, the B612 Foundation, whose entire purpose is to try and raise awareness, raise money to set up synoptic survey telescopes. Thing is, you can't do this from within the Earth's atmosphere, because the small objects like this, even when they pass quite close to the Earth, do not reflect enough light, except in very rare cases. In a few cases, we've been able to establish, basically, once an object has already hit the Earth, right, we've been able to backtrack and establish where it was before that, identify the object. In a very, very few cases, we've had a brief warning, like 48 hours of warning before it hit the Earth. But in general, you know, kilometer-sized objects in the inner solar system, we have a reasonable amount of coverage. It's not 100% by any means, but we have a reasonable amount of coverage. 100-meter-sized objects, much less. 20-meter-sized objects, virtually none. Probably more than 99% of the 20-meter-sized objects out there have not been identified. We have no knowledge of their position or their orbit. And that's bad, because one of those things can take out a city. And if it happens to take out a city at the wrong time, I mean, there is no right time, right? There's no right time for your city to be obliterated. But if it happens to take out a city in a country where there is a lot of international tension, I mean, just imagine. Imagine, you know, if one of these things were to hit in Kashmir, right? The Indians and the Pakistanis staring each other down. Both of them have nuclear weapons. Would that be good? I don't think so. Imagine it were to hit one of the smaller cities in Iran. Imagine if it were to hit Tel Aviv. Imagine if it were to hit Jeddah. You see where I'm going with this. There's a lot of places in the world where people would not be necessarily ready to step back and say, okay, let's take this to the United Nations, let's find out what happened, let's conduct a thorough investigation, where it's more likely that they would say, let's respond to the people we don't like this week with the biggest amount of military force at our disposal. So you could see a major war starting. You know, and I don't want a major war to start. I really don't. Because guess what? It's not good for anybody. It's one of the things that I really don't want to have happen. So I would definitely like to see some work done on identifying the degree to which the JWST, as a thermal infrared instrument, can track objects in our solar system. Very, very different from its design purpose, right? Which is to study basically the wallpaper of the universe. But track objects in our solar system which are very, very difficult to sense in visible light. Remember, of course, that our sun points out a lot of visible light, and, you know, it's a very strong emitter in the visible and a weak emitter in the thermal infrared. You know, that's one of the important things, right, about global climate, is that our Earth absorbs energy, which is in the near-infrared to near-ultraviolet mostly. That's where the energy is. Then the Earth re-radiates that energy at a much longer wavelength. In fact, that's why the James Webb Telescope has to be parked out at the Earth-Sun L2 point, and it also has this enormous sunshade, right? But the thing is, the Earth is such a colossal emitter of long-wave infrared that really parking the telescope any closer than that would cause serious problems. Anyway, so there are a lot of objects, particularly very dark, small diameter objects, because we realize now that most of the objects in the solar system are much darker than the Earth, right? I mean, our moon actually has a very low albedo, less than 20% of the light which strikes the moon is reflected. In fact, it's really considerably less than that. It's about the color of a charcoal briquette on average. But, you know, so thermal infrared may be a much better way of seeing the small objects that often are difficult to distinguish, partly because if they're in orbits that are relatively close to that of the Earth, in other words, orbits that cross the Earth and so on, many of the opportunities for seeing them come during sort of dusk and dawn periods when there's a lot of background diffused light when you're looking from the Earth. And even if you're looking from, say, lunar-based telescopes, which are a much better choice, right, that's where we really need to be putting our optical surveying instruments. Even then, when you're looking, say, in the direction of the Earth's orbit rather than away from the sun, there's actually diffused light caused by dust particles and so on orbiting around the Earth. So that's my that's my view, is that we should really look at the potential of the James Webb Space Telescope as a planetary defense instrument, because God knows nobody seems to be interested in ponying up the money and other resources to do synoptic survey. Now, I will tell you, right, as the guy who wants to go to the moon and live there, one of my priorities is going to be setting up telescopes. And here's the thing that you may not realize. In the amateur astronomy community today, there are a lot of people who are paying $10,000 to $50,000 apiece to have somebody go out in the desert. It may be the New Mexico desert, it may be the Atacama desert, and set up remotely operated telescopes where the seeing is much better. So they can sit in their apartments in New York or San Francisco and take astrophotographs, and, you know, it's really cool. Well, if there's thousands and thousands of people who are willing to do that to the tune of $10,000 to $50,000, then there are going to be a reasonable number, hundreds at least, of people who are willing to do that to the tune of $1 million or so for a lunar-based instrument. And that helps to subsidize the cost of going to the moon and living there, right? If we can tap into that. Well, here's the converse side of that, of course. When we have the capability to make the mirrors on site of local materials, make the housings, you know, we have to bring in the electronics for pointing them and communicating, the focal plane arrays, that kind of thing, right? Well, of course, we can at the same time offer this as a service to universities and other organizations, right? So it's kind of a case of you buy a space telescope as a hobbyist, or more likely a club. Right? There's even a company, SLOOH.com, SLOOH.com, which last time I heard was buying time on big astronomical observatory telescopes, again, to resell it to amateur astronomers. And if they might be interested in an instrument like that. Well, again, at the same time, we can set it up so that you buy this telescope and we also give one to a university or other research institution, right? And they can provide their own optics package, their own focal plane array, whatever. So if they want to look at, say, the far ultraviolet, which you can do with a lunar-based telescope, right? Because there's no atmosphere to get in the way. They want to look at something a little exotic, not the usual pretty visual light photographs. We can do that for them. So suddenly you can have a whole lot of space-based telescopes without the years of planning that normally goes into that. You say, basically, this is our standard telescope chassis. You just have to come up with the instruments you want attached to it, essentially. And this really makes a big difference in the world of space-based astronomy, in the world of astronomy, period. And it also means that we can get started doing synoptic surveys, because a large number of relatively small apertures, say 1 meter mirror, space-based telescopes, can do a whole lot more than corresponding telescopes on the Earth, just because they're not limited by the atmospheric interference which limits Earth-based telescopes. You know, with a telescope on the Moon, most of the observing targets that you have, you can look at them during the daytime, right, when the sun is in the sky. As long as you're more than about 10 degrees away from the sun, the sky is black, which means you can see anything. This really extends the range of your potential observations. Also, it's a very stable observing platform. Anyway, so that's my thought, you know, about the James Webb Space Telescope, about the future of astronomy generally. You know, I mean, I know there are some big projects that are still ongoing, say the 30-meter telescope and so forth, that they're building here on Earth. But I have to say, you know, these are really second best, right? These are the second best choices. These are the things that we're getting only because the astronomers did not get what they really wanted. You know, because if you look back in the 1950s, it's not just Dr. Richardson. It was everybody who was in agreement. You know, the last plate in Willy Ley's wonderful book, which is illustrated by Chesley Bonestell, in that wonderful book, The Conquest of Space, what is the last plate in that book? It's of a very mundane subject, the Mount Palomar Telescope, of which it says this is the last major optical observing instrument that will be constructed on the Earth. All future important astronomical telescopes will be in space or on the Moon. Period. End of sentence, right? That's the last thing in the book. So yeah, that is what I have to say about that, right? Now, I'm sure somebody is expecting me to talk about the situation in Germany, where I happen to be at the moment, the dire, dolorous, depressing situation in Germany, where, you know, the country has just lost 4,200 megawatts of nuclear generating capacity. Right. Zero emissions, all weather, highly reliable, high availability, dispatchable generating capacity. And if you ask most of the people in the country, they probably say it was a good thing, that they're somehow better off to have lost it. Now, it's hard for me to understand this, right? I mean, you can blame it on the moral cowardice of their politicians. You can blame it on the disinformation campaign, which has been conducted over decades, right, by various parties. You can blame it on the willingness of the average man in the street, the preference even for the average man in the street, for fairy tales over facts. You do all those things, but still, it still doesn't make a lot of sense. It's still hard to understand, at least for me. And it's, you know, I wonder, right? I wonder and I worry, because it seems almost like suicidal ideation. Honestly, it does. It seems as though this is Germany trying to resign from history. And, you know, I can understand why people might want Germany to resign from history. But it still seems rather a dubious choice to me. And I guess I should remind everyone, since I've used the word now, that in 1 minute, the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe will be airing here on Anon Radio. I wanted to tell everybody I did have a new film transferred. I should have talked about it several weeks ago, but I did have a new film transferred. It's called Fuel for the Future, and you can find it on Tubenix, tubenix.org. But yeah, this is the longest one to date. It's an animated film about nuclear energy, which comes from Britain and was sponsored by Mollard, makers of fine radio tubes. And hope you like it.
7, 6.